welcome back to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm your host, Jason Verlinde. As always, that's John Mauhouse. So, a short story. Around 3 months ago, a guitar box showed up at the Fretboard Journal. Now, this is not anything unusual. We get guitar boxes all the time sent to us, people wanting us to check out their instruments. I wasn't paying much attention. I opened the box. I took out the guitar. It was this beautiful Dreadnought. It's definitely contemporary. It's definitely modern, but it sounded damn good. And it had no label on the inside. There was no maker's name on the headstock. It was too mystery. I had to go look at the box, and then I realized this thing was sent to us from Yamaha. I didn't see this one coming. This was not on my radar. I wanted to hear more about it. I reached out to the senders, Yamaha. I want to hear more about this thing. I wanted to hear how it was made, who made it. And it turned out it was made in California by a luthier named Andrew Enns, who works for Yamaha. I was not aware of any of this stuff going on, but it turns out Yamaha has a custom shop in California where they are building instruments one at a time by hand, just like all the individual luthiers we talk to day in and day out at the Fretboard Journal. And he is making guitars that will end up eventually becoming production line guitars for Yamaha that are made overseas. In the case of this particular instrument that I got, he did an incredible job. And I wanted to hear about it, and I wanted to hear about him. And that is the conversation you are about to hear. Yamaha and the Fretboard Journal will be working together on a few other things over the course of 2022. I'm really excited to share them. They're also going to be sponsoring our Fretboard Summit in Chicago, August 25th to 27th. I'm super excited about that. If you show up at that summit, you're probably going to be able to get your hands on one or two of these guitars that we're talking about. But in the meantime, let me just tell you, it held its own amongst all the other high-end dreadnoughts I've seen of late. And I was really fascinated by Andrew's build process, what he's doing, what he's not doing, and just the thought that's going on behind the scenes over at Yamaha. I hope you enjoy this chat. As always, our podcast is brought to you by a handful of sponsors. Those include Kalton Cases, makers of the greatest flight case in the world, Peghead Nation, your home for roots music instruction. If you head on over to the show notes, we have a special offer just for Fretboard Journal podcast listeners over at Peghead Nation. Our friends at iZotope, if you head on over to the show notes, we have a great deal on iZotope software if you want to try that out. And our friends over in New York City at RetroFret Vintage Guitars, one of the greatest vintage guitar stores in the world. Thanks to all of our sponsors. Our 50th issue of the Fretboard Journal is out now. You can go get it by subscribing at fretboardjournal.com, or if you're already a subscriber, just look in your mailbox in the next week or so, you're going to find it. And I hope you enjoy this chat with Andrew at Yamaha. Well, Andrew, thank you for talking to us here on the Fretboard Journal podcast. I know a little bit about you, but not a lot. I know you're doing some exciting things over at Yamaha right now, but let's start at the beginning. Like, where did you grow up, and when did luthery enter your life?
Well, I grew up in California, Central Valley, in a farming area outside of Fresno. And I was always around, my family are either engineers or farmers. And then they're also like part-time contractors. I don't know. My family did a whole lot of things. So my grandparents on both sides were carpenters, certified carpenters. And I think it kind of just runs in the family. Like from when I was a tiny little kid, I'd go to my dad's father's house and he'd show me how to cut things with a coping saw. You know, I could barely do anything. And I'm like using a coping saw and trying to cut a straight line or anything. And then making stuff in my parents' garage. It was like, I want this kind of toy, or I want this, and I'll just make one. So playing with wooden toys that my dad made when he was a kid, because his family was too poor to buy toys, so he made his own toys. I started playing guitar at about 10, and I didn't really stick. I was sort of like interested in it, but not really. I didn't have an outlet to play. And then I got good enough that my mom kind of forced me to play in church. And so I was like reluctantly playing hymns on acoustic guitar in church. And then it was sort of forced me to get better. Kind of the guitar bug hit around high school when I learned, and I discovered like metal, like playing Metallica, playing or like punk, playing like distorted heavy guitar. And then at about the same time, I was like a shop nerd. I took shop classes. I was in metal shop. I was in wood shop. I took shops too much and they wouldn't let me take it anymore. So I became the shop teacher's assistant. And so I was in shop class all the time. And there was this old laminate electric guitar body, like a Les Paul body, like flat top, just kind of that had been hanging out in there. And it kind of dawned on me, like, guitars are made out of wood. I know how to make things out of wood. You know, maybe this is something I should try. And of course, I was like, you know what? I'm not going to go basic. I want to make right out of the gate my dream guitar. So I ever since I started playing electric guitar, I wanted to buy a PRS Custom 24 with, like, I think they called it a 10 top, you know, flame maple top, fancy. So I decided that's what I'm going to make. Arch or a carved top, maple, flame maple, mahogany, but I don't want the same things. I want to do something different. I want to do different inlays and I want binding and I want, you know, I decided I was going to, but then I was like, okay, I have no idea how to do any of this. I don't know a single person who's ever made a guitar. And then over the course of about a year, I just slowly, as I got some money, bought parts. I bought a truss rod. I bought a pre-slotted fretboard from Stumac at the time. This was before YouTube. This was 2000, 2001. Mm-hmm. And so I just was using Stumac, like the physical magazine or the physical catalog. I found a website, Ed Roman Guitars, mm-hmm. where he was doing all kinds of ridiculous top replacements and yep. abalone and stuff. And I thought that was cool at the time. And then he had a whole bunch of articles and rants about how he thought a guitar should be made and designed. And so I took some of that ideas and ran with that. And so over the course of a year, I built this guitar, did a rattle can spray finish on it. It turned out better than anybody else expected it to turn out, but not quite as good as I hoped it would turn out. Even, you know, my parents who have always been super supportive of me, or they were kind of like, I don't know about this one. you can really make a guitar. I'm not sure. And then so I'm like, but I'm going to do it. So I stuck with it, finally did it. It plays. I still own it. It intonates, it's playable. The binding is peeling off and stuff like that, 'cause I didn't do a good job gluing it on, but I carved the top. I put carbon rods in the neck next to the truss rod. I did all the stuff. And then I'd look back at it and like, I should have just gone simple and made it like basic flat top, one pickup or something like that. But that's when it hit. That's when the bug, I guess you could say, when I got the guitar building bug, 'cause then it was like, well, okay, now I've done this. Now, what did I make mistakes on? How did I do it wrong? And how am I going to do it right the next time? Yeah. And so then it was just electric guitars, and it was just me trial and error, figuring it out, doing as much internet research and magazine research as I could, and figuring and like, cause I still didn't know anybody who built guitars. But then I guess I did that as a hobby for, I don't know, 5-6 years, just building my own guitars. I sold a couple, but just kind of building them for myself. And then I went to college. I was going to be an engineer in college, but then it was kind of like, you know what? I don't really care about just drawing these pictures of stuff on paper and then someone else builds it. I want to be the guy that builds it. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I don't want to sit in a desk all day and be proud of this design and then have somebody else actually make it a reality. So I dropped out of college for a moment and got a job working at a guitar company doing customer service because I brought in a guitar I made and said, well, it looks like you know what you're talking about. So here's a job. And that was with Michael Kelly Guitars. Mm-hmm. They did OLP, which is a Ernie Ball licensed import line at the time. Mm-hmm. And they did mandolins and I don't even remember now. My mandolins and electric guitars when I was there. And so I did customer service for them for a while and did some repairs and stuff like that. And maybe a couple years. And then they eliminated that position and moved it across the country. And so I went back to college, got a degree in film production, believe it or not.
Okay.
Which I don't use at all today.
Okay.
And then I was like, man, working in Hollywood at a job I really did not like, making very little money and commuting a long distance. And then I was like, I need to find a better job than this. And so then I found a job for Cordoba Guitars through, I think it was Craigslist. And so I applied to Cordoba Guitars to do quality control. And then same kind of thing, brought in a guitar I made and same response. Looks like you know what you're doing. So yeah, sure, we'll hire you. So then I feel like I'm doing the whole expanding a lot more on your question, but
I mean the entire time
this is a whole life story going on.
I love it. The entire time when you're working for these companies and then the job that you didn't even like, are you also building at home? Are you still?
I lived in Orange County, California in an apartment and I was literally building electric guitars on like a 5-foot by 8-foot patio outside. I'd talk to my neighbor and say, hey, I'm going to make some noise for a minute. It's just a handheld router and I'm making a guitar. And he was like, what?
Yeah.
And then I showed him and he was like, oh, actually that's really cool. Go ahead. No problem. And so I would be making guitars and then I tell them the same thing, like if I spray some lacquer out my patio off my back patio and they say it might smell a little bit, it's lacquer, you know, it'll dissipate quick.
Yeah. I mean, this whole time, I mean, it sounds like you're largely, I mean, you had this in your DNA, but it sounds like you're largely self-taught. At any point, did you go to a traditional luthier and say, you know, shadow them or go to any of those schools?
No, not at all. At this point, I am entirely self-taught and internet taught.
Yeah.
Well, still even like before YouTube, but just trial and error taught. You know, I sort of discovered my own way that worked for me to do things because I didn't have the space or the tools to do things, you know, the proper way. I was like on the floor or making my own bench or doing things in a way that I had to do them to make it work for my space. Mm-hmm. And, but then I got this job at Cordoba doing quality control. And I was still making guitars and I'd bring guitars in and show them and do repairs and stuff for Cordoba. And then after, I forget how many years, 3 or 4 years. No, it wasn't even that long. Maybe 3 years. They were expanding and wanted to start manufacturing classical guitars in the United States. And I was like, if you guys do this, I'm in on it. Like, not even like I want to be in on it. It's like, I am in on it. and they sort of like, yeah, that sounds good. And, you know, not really knowing if it was going to happen, but that ended up happening. They moved to Oxnard, California, bought a warehouse. We built a small shop in the corner of the warehouse. And then Kenny Hill came on board. Kenny had been designing guitars for Cordoba and having them made in China. So he already had a relationship with Cordoba at the time. And then, the owner of Cordoba Tim McClouchy owned Guitar Salon, which is still in Santa Monica, and they deal in high-end classical guitars. And so with Tim and with the resources at Guitar Salon and with Kenny coming in and showing me physically how his method of building acoustic guitars was, I really dove deep into high-end classical guitar with kind of reverse engineering some of the greatest guitars ever made, from like Antonio de Torres and Herman Hauser first. And that was my deep dive into acoustic guitar. And because I already sort of cut my teeth building electric guitars and discovering what's right and wrong about doing that, I think it came naturally, building acoustic and sort of kind of adapting a make it work no matter the situation type of build process. So the fact that we were building a shop from the ground up and starting this new line of classical guitars, bringing in Kenny Hill, and he is teaching me how, and then he brought in a builder that had been working with him from Mexico named Fructoso Zalapa, who is from, you know, Paracho, Mexico. Mm-hmm. And I think he said he had won they have an annual guitar building competition there, and he had won a couple times. He was a great builder. And he, although spoke basically no English, we communicated through like woodworking, and he'd show me something and then I'd show him like something too. And then sort of like this just almost like mimed collaborative relationship of kind of almost like a mentorship sort of, I wouldn't call it any of it really a traditional apprenticeship type of situation, because Kenny wasn't there every single day for years. He came and stayed a week and would like, okay, to this week, we're going to go over Torres. We're going to design and essentially build a Torres and then kind of go over the specs. And then he brought some templates and this is how I do this part and this is how we do this. And then, so I went through Torres, Hauser, Rodriguez, and Reyes, the four different master series guitars for Cordoba. And then we kind of built those exactly as either, I think there's the GAL plans for a couple of them, the Guild of American Luthiers plans for a couple of them, that we built the first few like exactly to those plans. And then kind of spun off and did our own thing, where it was like, you know what? We're not getting the results we want from these exact plans. Let's branch out a little and kind of, so we brought some Hauser guitars in, reverse engineered them. They're all different, but you couldn't like nail down, oh, well, Hauser always does this.
Sure.
And it was so it was like, well, if Hauser doesn't do everything consistent, that doesn't mean we have to do everything exactly the same. So let's just make the best sounding Hauser style guitar we can. But essentially going through all of those high end guitars and trying to get into the brain and mentality of some of the great builders, I think that really was like a huge lesson in guitar design, guitar construction, especially nylon string construction, that I at the time occasionally was like, this is really cool. I kind of can't believe that I get to do this. Mm-hmm. But also, like, you know, some of it went over my head at the time, but I'm super grateful to have had that ability and that experience to be able to, you know, handle all those amazing guitars and learn from the people that, you know, have come before us in guitar building.
Yeah. It's a whole, I mean, nylon string guitar is a whole universe unto itself. Like,
yes.
Were you able to pretty quickly pick up the subtleties between the different models and what accomplished classical players were kind of seeking, or was there a whole learning curve there
too? Oh, there's a huge learning curve there. It didn't come quickly. There's you pick up on the subtleties, like what makes each model kind of distinct, you know, what feel or what sound characteristics make those models distinct. And then, but that leap between like, this sounds like a good production guitar, mm-hmm. to like, this sounds like a handmade guitar. That leap was like, you know, we'd jump back and forth and it was like, okay, what did we hit it this time? What did we do that nailed it? And then try to like hone in on the little tweaks that we were doing each time so that we can nail it each time. And that was a learning curve, basically like, okay, well now we gotta pick better woods. We can't just, you know, we have, and that's a lot of it is wood selection. It's like, well, we can't just use all the wood we have. You know, I know it's graded and it's technically supposed to be like master grade wood, but you got to go through that stack of master grade wood, pick the ones that are actually good, you know, and then the ones that are not quite good enough, just don't use them. Find another utility for those pieces of wood, you know, cut them up into back strips or you know, something like that. So it's and the classical guitar player, the crowd that buys high-end nylon string guitars, I say is some of the pickiest people on the planet.
Sure.
And I'll say that to their faces if they're listening, because they probably know it.
They take pride in it, I'm sure.
and trying to make that crowd happy is a lot of work. And you know, you got to really swallow a lot of pride as a builder and take criticism over and over again, especially when you're learning. And that's kind of like, that was a big lesson too. It's like, you know, you kind of have to have confidence in your builds in order to do the job right, you know, and also in order to essentially sell your product, you have to believe that they're good. And so, you know, if you hand somebody a guitar and you go, well, I put this together, it might be okay. I don't know. You know, you be the judge, you know, it's all right. They're going to be like, well, okay. Maybe not. But if you hand them a guitar and you tell them like, man, this has the best wood in it. I got this from here. And like, this is the most cutting edge design. Sure. And you know, if you sell it, then it's like, okay, well, then they come into it. But if you do that and then someone crushes your soul when they say, wow, this is trash, then you're like, man, okay. Let me step back and then say, okay, well, what is good? What isn't good? How can I fix it? And then that, I think that approach helps you grow faster and helps you make a better guitar. A lot of it's easy to be full of yourself when you're doing something that people find that interesting. You know, sure. when you're in a group of people who are, I could be in a group of lawyers and doctors, and I say, I build guitars, and all the lawyers and doctors will be like, ooh, interesting. Wow. And I'll be like, yeah, super cool. Right. But at the same time, like, you know, I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm just, you know, a woodworker. I just know how to use a chisel and a plane.
Yeah. Were you still going home or staying after hours and working on electrics the entire time you're trying to perfect classical guitars?
Yes, not nearly as much, but I was still working on electrics. You know, my wife would be like, you know, your guitar all day long and you're also guitar all evening long. And I'm like, I can't help it. So, but that it did slow down a little bit because, my emphasis at that time was definitely getting better at classical guitar. Cause at the time I was like, I'm satisfied with my electric guitars. I didn't feel like there was anything that I wanted to necessarily make better. Just like, you know, I want to get better at design. I want to make a cooler looking electric guitar. But that's the thing with electric guitars. Like you get to where your fit and finish is satisfactory and good. Your fretwork is good. And then it's like, well, what electronics? You just put the ones that you like in it. And it's kind of like, that's as far as you go. And you're not happy with the way it sounds. You put different electronics in it.
Sure.
But then acoustic guitar, especially nylon string, it's like, well, I did the fit and finish is awesome, but it doesn't sound as good as it should. Can't do anything about that. I have to make another one and try better.
Did you have to like grow out your fingernails and learn some rudimentary classical guitar technique just to be able to do that?
I did learn some rudimentary classical guitar technique. I did not grow out my nails.
Okay.
I just accepted that I was going to have a warmer tone than most classical players, and I would not be a flamenco player at all.
Okay.
And that's actually something that I feel like I got to a point where I was like, I'm competent in my classical guitar building. Flamenco, I'm still like, that's still hit or miss. I still want to improve on my flamenco guitar because that's something that I didn't get enough attempts at Cordoba, where there weren't enough orders for flamenco guitars that I was able to really like feel like I got that down. Plus I can't play flamenco. I don't have that like right hand.
Yeah.
I don't have that right hand technique down.
I'm not even going to get into the weeds of the difference between a classical guitar and a flamenco guitar right now. When did you move over to Yamaha?
I moved over to Yamaha 4 years ago, 2018. Mm-hmm. Basically like it was time to kind of like grow and steel string guitars. Classical guitars were never part of my culture growing up. I loved the craft of it, but I definitely didn't grow up in a world surrounded by classical music or even like flamenco or Spanish style music or anything like that. But I did grow up in a house filled with country music, filled with folk music, John Denver, and you know, all kinds of stuff. So the idea of diving deep, kind of like I did with classical, but into steel string acoustic was very attractive. And Yamaha's a great company, and I very much enjoy working for Yamaha. But that was 2018.
And what was the, I mean, Yamaha, we all know, has made incredibly consistent, beautiful, affordable guitars overseas. Everybody's, hopefully, I'd imagine most folks have tried those out or thought about those. But what was the actual job description and what was Yamaha's presence in California when you were applying for that job?
Yeah, so I think surprising to me, as it is still a lot of people now, Yamaha has a custom shop in Los Angeles and has for 30 years. It has primarily been in the electric guitar and electric bass world. They do horns and stuff like that too, out of their headquarters here in Southern California. But this specific facility was electric guitars, electric basses, and drums. So they did not have an acoustic guitar builder this whole time. All of the acoustic guitar, I think it's something Yamaha sort of, you know, held close, is acoustic guitar, because that's kind of their, other than piano, as far as like the guitar is kind of like one of their, acoustic guitar is one of their signatures.
Sure.
And the job description was artist services and research and development. And so it was a little like broad, like, okay, what does that entail? And so during the interview process, I said, what does a day-to-day job look like? You know, what percentage of it is R&D? What percentage is artist relations?
Yeah.
And it was like, well, maybe 60-40, you know, 60% R&D, 40% artist relations. And then what does artist relations do and what does R&D do? Well, artist relations aspect of it is custom modifications. You know, if an artist wants a guitar with a specific kind of electronics in it or a custom paint job. Actually, we do a lot of custom paint work and a lot of retrofitting of things. So we'll do custom modifications and customization of production guitars. Mm-hmm. And then for certain artists, certain like higher level artists that have a specific need or have a big enough following, a big enough influence, we'll do custom guitars. And then the research and development side is after I got the job is kind of where I've been spending most of my time is building prototypes, communicating directly with engineers in Japan about, you know, how I build acoustic guitars. And then, well, we want to make this guitar sound brighter, or we want to make this guitar sound darker, or how do we make this guitar more lively? And then it's just kind of back and forth communication about that. And then I often build a prototype. Like, I guess I could start on like the prototype process, because I think it's best explained just kind of walking through the whole process of like, okay, what is the R&D process like?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
Yeah. So it often starts with an existing product that we want to redesign or essentially like overhaul or modify. It's like this guitar we've had in our line for 10 years now, and it's due for kind of like an upgrade. So they will ask me to make a couple prototypes of my interpretation. What should this guitar be? Where I get full rein on how it's going to sound, what the bracing is going to be, within the parameters of like, it's got to be this body shape. We really want the scale length, and we really want this type of wood for the top, probably these for the back and the sides. So there's some parameters where they're like, these are the kind of the guidelines among where, you know, these are the fences that you could play in. And so then I will design and come up with two guitars of my own, out of my own head. And then they will give me two guitars or more, maybe four guitars that the engineers in Japan have designed. And they give me 3D imaging of that. And then I will have to construct those exactly as their 3D imaging, which was a huge learning curve coming from a traditional hand building everything. No CNC,
no blueprint.
It's like you literally draw the brace pattern on the top and then glue the pieces of wood on those pencil line that you drew to like, okay, here's an exact model that you need to reproduce as exact as possible. You know, the brace shape, everything, the position of the braces, everything. So down to within half a millimeter tolerance or even less. I tell the story sometimes that first few guitars where they had me do that, I built the guitars the way I knew how to build them. Just draw the pencil line, put it down on the exact pencil line, and then sent them the guitars, and they measured them with lasers, CT scanned them, x-rayed them, and then were like, you know, the guitars sounded great, but it doesn't really give us a great reference as to how it compares to our design, because the bracing on certain places was off by like half a millimeter here and a millimeter over here. And I was like, half a millimeter? Like if I push the wood, if I put glue down and it like scoots just a tiny little bit, that's half a millimeter. So I was like, okay, well, I couldn't just say, you know what, you guys are going to have to deal with that. Mm-hmm. I had to be like, okay, I will come up with a way to ensure it being exact. So I came up with these templates that hold the braces in exact, like snap in, all the braces snap into this template and they're glued. It's like a vacuum. So nothing moves. And that, that satisfied them. So I was kind of like, whew, okay, good. But, then we kind of backtrack a second. I make a couple guitars out of my head. Then they give me some of their designs and I make those. And then we evaluate all of them. We bring, musicians in, we evaluate them with just the people who play within the company. And we decide like which one's the best, which one has qualities we're looking for. And then from there, we kind of decide the direction we want to go. Do we want to go with the one I made? Do we want to go with one of the ones they designed? Or is it like a hybrid? If it's a hybrid, then it's like, okay, now we need a next round of prototypes where we try out that hybrid. But it always leads to a next round of prototypes where we refine the direction. And that's kind of what happens is there's the initial round where we decide what direction we want to go. And then after that, it's okay, we've decided the direction. Now let's make the perfect guitar that's in that direction. Whether it's like bluegrass or, is it a finger style guitar or is it like just a campfire guitar, whatever. So then each guitar is kind of tailored for that specific genre even. But
wow.
The last guitars that we just kind of finished up my stage of the prototyping, I think I made 40 prototypes for these two models. So yeah, about 40 guitars, 40 prototypes. And some of them were kind of redundant. Like, okay, well now we've decided this is kind of the spec we want. Now let's make one with a bridge that's a light, tiny bit smaller. Let's make one instead of a double action truss rod, let's put like a traditional single action truss rod in it. And this one, let's do a dovetail. And this one, let's do a mortise and tenon. And then one change in like this, a batch of six guitars and each one has one small change in it. And then we evaluate, what did that change do? That's not necessarily for the purpose of which one of those things is better. Is a smaller bridge better? Is it more just intended better? It's like, what measurable difference did those changes have? And then how do we apply that to future? Like, okay, well, we know that going from this type of truss rod to this type of truss rod, gives us less volume or more volume. Then if we are in a later stage where it's like, well, we want just a little more volume, but we don't want to change the tone, we'll put a different truss rod in it that does that or something like that. So it's kind of a filling up the database of ideas, kind of like to slowly chip away at, to scientifically slowly chip away at the magic that makes an acoustic guitar great. So we can almost like, find the formula.
Yeah. Well, I've got to stop you since not many guitar makers or guitar players ever have the luxury of being able to sort of A/B test those little subtle variations. Which one's had the most dramatic like effect where you're like, holy crap, this is totally different than this one? Or where were the big differences?
The biggest differences really are adjusting plate thicknesses. The difference between a 3 millimeter top and a 3.1 millimeter top are much more significant than what type of truss rod you put in it or what type of neck joint you use. So when it comes to like, we didn't do, there are a million different minute changes you can make, And that's a million prototypes. You know, I can't, you can't make a million prototypes and put on, you know, oh, well, this one has, you know, locking tuners. This one doesn't have, this one has, you know, these type of frets and this one has different frets, you know? So it's, but when, basically when it came down to it, it was like, okay, these all make a subtle, subtle difference, like type of truss rod, type of neck joint, size of the bridge. I mean, it was a small change in the size of the bridge. And then it was like back thickness, top thickness, side thickness, things like that. The biggest change is in the plate thicknesses, back and top, really. And
interesting.
Yeah. So, but yeah, there's a whole lot of, guitar building has a lot of tradition in it. And there's a lot of things you're just not allowed to change because of tradition. And then sort of, it's fun sometimes to chip at that tradition and be like, why are you not allowed to change this? You know, why does like dovetail joints in a guitar, why does it have to be a dovetail joint? Why is that better? It's like, is it better? Well, I don't know. Let's make different types of neck joints and see which one is better. And I'm convinced the dovetail joints are not better. Mm-hmm. They are one way to attach a neck and a body that has worked. You know, it doesn't mean that it's the only way to do it. Classical guitars, if it's not a Spanish heel, it's not a true classical guitar. You make a dovetail joint or a bolt-on neck on a classical guitar, and it's kind of, that's not traditional. You can't do that. Like a urethane on a classical guitar, that's a no-no. I will agree, though, that is actually a no-no. You should not put urethane on a, on a classical.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the other thing I keep thinking about when you're describing these like super high tolerances that, I mean, Yamaha, like I said, they're very consistent guitars and have been for decades now.
Yes.
You're dealing with wood, which is an organic matter. Like, what do you guys do to on the wood end to just make sure that each piece is as consistent from guitar to guitar as possible?
Well, the biggest thing is, it helps when you make a whole bunch of levels of guitar from high end to very low end, because then you can buy a ton of wood and grade it such that, you know, each, the highest quality only gets used for this certain tier. And then the next tier uses the next quality. And it's really down to how you treat the wood, making sure it's dry, how you grade it. And then taking as much human error out of the build process as possible so that the build method is consistent. And then Yamaha also has an insane quality control guideline. You know, when I build a prototype, they have to test it thoroughly. They drop test it. They put it in extreme humidity. They put it in extreme dry. They put it in extreme cold and extreme hot. They have a whole list of tests, physical demanding tests that it has to meet. And then once it gets through all the tests, then they measure it and determine if the wood moves too much or if there's gaps that there shouldn't be or how everything held up. That's why everybody has a cheap Yamaha guitar that still plays fine, because they've had these insane quality control guidelines that everything has to go through. So not only is it, they won't even make something that's questionable. Like, it won't go into production if it doesn't meet these guidelines. And then once it does, then it's meticulously monitored as it goes through the process. And if there's any issue, they'll stop production, they'll fix the issue, and then restart. And it's for the size of Yamaha, how big and how many instruments Yamaha makes worldwide, to me, that's an unfathomable feat that we somehow accomplish. Mm-hmm. So
I'm scared to ask, but I mean, everybody's seen the footage of like the crash test for new cars. Is there something similar going on at Yamaha with guitars being dropped off a ledge or something?
Yes, but no, it's not quite as, documented as that.
Okay.
It's, you know, I don't want to watch that.
Yeah. Yeah.
To me, the sound of an acoustic guitar like hitting the ground is like,
it's not good.
Worse than nails on a chalkboard. Yeah. It is like the worst sound, something about it. But, yeah, it's they, you know, they even before they do it, they tell me, hey, we're going to test your guitar, or we're going to kind of destroy your guitar on purpose. Is that okay? And I'm like, yeah, I mean, you know, you have to. And that's, as a builder, there is a luxury, like you said, like in making all these small little changes and being able to build guitars almost just to go through the motions of it. Mm-hmm. And to be able to build a guitar that's just going to be like destroyed is kind of a luxury. Like what is my guitar able to handle? You know, when you build a guitar and you send it out in the world, it's like, you know, I know, I think it can handle this, but I don't know that for sure, 'cause it's never actually been put to the test. You know, what will it take? And so to kind of to see these things get pushed to the limit, it's knowledge. You know, it gives you an idea of how well things hold together, how well they don't. So,
I mean, you're obviously on a timeline that's much longer than I think probably most guitar manufacturers, where it's like, you know, I guess in the old days we would say you got to release a new guitar for NAMM or whatever. You're probably looking out a couple years,
yes,
as opposed to 6 months from now. But why don't we talk a little bit about the, you know, I've had the luxury of been playing with this custom shop AG Dreadnought that you guys sent over. Mm-hmm. Thoroughly impressed, but like, let's use that as a real world example of like, how did that guitar end up being what it was, and what was the original idea?
Well, it started out as, let's make a Dreadnought. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what should a Dreadnought sound like? And I'm like, okay, well, who plays Dreadnoughts? Singer-songwriters, bluegrass guys, country guys, everybody plays Dreadnoughts. So it's kind of a broad idea of what should a Dreadnought be. So we made, I think I made a round of like 10 prototypes at the beginning. And all different kinds of bracing, different woods, different features. And then had a bunch of people play them. And it's like, okay, well, we like these, but for different reasons. You know, we like this one because of this reason. We like this one because of this reason. And then we sort of established like, okay, well, who are the big Dreadnought guys out there? There's Martin, there's Gibson, there's Collings, there's Santa Cruz, there's, you know, Husson Dalton, there's Preston Thompson, there's all these guys who are kind of at the top of the Dreadnought game. And who are the guys that play those? Mm-hmm. It's like, if we're going to make a Dreadnought, a top tier Dreadnought, it's got to compete with what people perceive as the best Dreadnoughts out there. So then it's like a bluegrass guys. It's got to be for the flat pickers, the guys who play loud, who want volume. Okay, so that's what we decided. It's going to be a loud guitar. It's going to be for flat pickers. It has to be big sounding. And then that sort of determined what it's going to be made out of and how we're going to brace it and stuff like that. So, you know, without revealing too much information, I guess it's, you know, Adirondack spruce is kind of like, if you want to make a loud, punchy bluegrass Dreadnought, Adirondack spruce should be what you use for the top. And then it's just like, okay, well, what do we want the Yamaha scent to be like? We can't just straight up copy Martin, or we can't copy Martin specifically because they invented it, you know. We can't copy Martin. And to not bash on other people, but that's kind of what the trend is. It's like, let's just copy Martin and try to make a better sounding Martin, you know, down to the pickguard shape and the headstock shape and the, you know, back strip and everything. And so it's like, well, we're Yamaha. We have our own history and our own guitars. What do we sound like? What do people know us as? And it's like, oh, Yamaha has more of a resonant quality to it. Mm-hmm. It's bright. It's not huge and bassy. It's not super mid-rangey. It's got a lot of harmonics, a lot of clarity. It's like, okay, let's try to make a big dreadnought that has harmonics and clarity. And that's essentially a lot of discussion about what the sound is going to be, and then sort of making bracing tweaks and top thickness tweaks and neck tweaks to try and hone in on that kind of description of a sound.
Can I ask a dumb question?
Yes.
I mean, aside from what you described with these like half millimeter exacting measurements, if somebody were to take the top off of a Yamaha and a Martin or a Collings, like are Yamahas built fundamentally differently? And like, is the bracing different? Are a great acoustic guitar is a great acoustic guitar?
They're not fundamentally built differently.
Yeah.
The braces will, to the layman, it will look like, what's the difference?
Okay.
You know? It'll have X and the two-tone bars, and but the dimensions of the bracing, kind of the angle of the X, where the everything is located, is all slightly different from maker to maker, and then how the dimensions of the bracing and the thicknesses of the plates and even kind of the body shape itself is all the little things that kind of add up to what makes the sound. And so, and that's the mystery. It's kind of like, well, how can all of these guitars look so similar inside and out, but sound different all at the same time? And that's the fun in acoustic guitar making, really, is the detail, kind of the mystery and the details.
I don't know what your shop setup looks like, but I have to imagine Yamaha in Japan and probably Taylor are like two of the most state-of-the-art guitar making facilities. Do you guys have the ability, or are you about to have the ability to just even model, like, if we move the brace a half millimeter this way, this is what's going to happen to the frequency response?
Yes, we have that. In our shop, no, I don't have the knowledge, sure, of the sure, software to do that personally. Yeah.
You don't have the lab coat on.
No, I don't. But our team are the engineers in Japan that work directly with me, and they're the feeding me like, okay, we see your designs. Here's our design, or here's our modification to your design. And they virtually build the guitar. They have a 3D image of the guitar, and they are able to simulate the frequency response of that guitar and the different modal vibrations of the body, and then get, you know, frequency maps and everything as if it were a real guitar. And
wild.
I've heard them say they're like within 5 to 10% of the real thing, something like that. You know, don't quote me on that because I'm not sure. But they are pretty close in predicting the frequency response of the guitar. There's some other factors like feel. When you play a guitar, it has a specific feel to it. There's kind of no way to map that. Mm-hmm. As far as a frequency map of like, this is the resonant frequency of this guitar, these are where the peaks and valleys are. And then the modal vibrations, they can predict that.
Okay. Wow. This is going deep. You can build this guitar to these exacting standards using a little help from science, but I imagine guitars being like super personal things. Then when you finally hand it to a flat picker or a singer songwriter, mm-hmm, they're going to have their own feedback and they don't care what the spreadsheet said.
Correct. Yeah. They don't care how it was designed or built. They just care if it speaks to them.
And what was that process like? When did you finally let somebody hold this guitar and strum it?
Well, all along the way. I mean, these guitars, that's as much of a vital role of part of the R&D process as the 3D mapping and simulation. At every step of the process, they're putting in people's hands from the very beginning, the very first prototypes to the most recent ones that one of which you have over there. Mm-hmm. It's like, what do people think? And does it feel like a robot design this, or does it feel like a human design this? And I don't know if you could say that any guitar feels like a robot designed it, but anyway, it's I don't know. That's a very crucial part of the whole process, is the human and how the human perceives the guitar.
Yeah.
And that's something I, since I started here, I've been very vocal about, is that it's not about if part of it is the frequency, you know, what frequencies does this have? The third party, like when you're standing in front of somebody playing a guitar, does it sound good? What do you say? Does it sound bright or bassy or punchy? Or does it have a focused mid range or whatever, however you want to describe the frequency? But generally, the guy buying the guitar is the person playing it, not the person listening to it. Mm-hmm. So you want the person playing it to feel that guitar. The neck has to feel right. The vibrations has to vibrate right. It has to, there's a lot of setup and feel stuff. And to me, it's like one chord. Like I just, you know, pick up the guitar and strum a G or an E. And it's from that, like that one chord, you know, if you like the guitar or not. It's usually not like a maybe. It's mm-hmm. like, yeah, or a no. And then you can dive deeper and start playing different things. And like, okay, yeah, it plays really well. It has good upper register. It plays, you know, the nitpicky stuff. But to know if it's a good or a bad guitar, it takes one strum. Mm-hmm.
So in the case of the Custom Shop AG, obviously you're happy enough with it to send it to me, at least to try it out for a little while, which I'm very grateful for. But like, how much of that was that completely built in California?
Yes.
So what's your shop look like? Like, what, walk me through, paint the picture. What does this place look like?
Well, the shop is, I don't know square footage, but it's not terribly large. It's maybe, I'm going to guess 20 by 80 feet is the shop.
Long and skinny.
And long and skinny. We've got a CNC machine. Mm-hmm. We've got a 36 inch wide belt sander, a table saw, a couple band saws, a planer, a couple of drill presses. It's really like a garage shop. It's, you know, there's no, I don't have a laser cutter. There's some things I still want, but it's a garage. It's like a dream garage shop. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of boutique builders out there, their shops probably look very similar minus the CNC machine.
Yeah.
And then we have, a pretty good size paint booth as well. That's a one thing that most boutique guys don't have is an auto body paint booth. And so, but that's it. That's the shop. And like I said, maybe I build 40 guitars a year. And that's acoustic. And we have a guy building electrics who, I don't know how many he builds, but, that's the, and then there's a shop assistant builder who assists me, and an electric guy building. So, and then, and there's a drum guy too, who does custom drums, and he's kind of working on his own, but, it's four of us essentially sharing this shop.
It's so small.
It doesn't feel small because we all kind of, unless we all need to use the CNC machine at the same time, then
it's only small when you put the word Yamaha in front of it. And then I'm like, they've got four people working on one. It's just,
yeah. And I think that's kind of part of it is even though Yamaha's huge and there's a lot of stuff that goes on, Yamaha makes a lot of stuff. And so they need a group of people to design and make all that stuff. So each team is not that big. So our R&D team for this last project, that Dreadnought, is, you know, roughly 6 people. Mm-hmm. And so some engineers, some product managers, a guitar builder, like a graphic designer. Yeah, it's not too big, but I think it helps make decisions faster that way. Mm-hmm. Even though we do take a long time to develop something, it's not because we can't make a decision. It's because we go through so many little details that takes a while, and everything has to be vetted. Every process has to be confirmed mathematically, you know, scientifically and physically. So it's not just like, well, we think it works. Mm-hmm. It works on paper, so we'll assume. It's like, no, let's make it and confirm that it works. And then let's have evaluations with real world people. Well, they tell us that it works too.
Yeah. Yeah. So how do you know when it's done? Because you could always refine one more thing.
You could. And that is a tough thing is it's kind of like when you start making prototypes and the measurements and improvement are almost not measurable, or they're so small that they're kind of like a matter of taste now and not really like kind of like an improvement. It's like, well, I like the last one better. Well, I like this one better. You know, that's kind of when you know, okay, I think we're done making it better. Unless somebody has any more kind of meaningful ideas, rather than like, well, I think, you know, maybe the binding should be, you know, a little bit thicker. It's like, no, that's not going to make a difference in the sound. But.
And then, you know, you are basically a one-man shop working under the Yamaha umbrella. Is the goal for the guitar that you just finally finished to be made in Japan, or are you just going to make them as folks order them?
The goal is for them to be made in Japan. The way the process as the development process goes, like they start off being 100% handmade. Like I will cut the braces and hand carve every brace with a chisel and tweak every top with a scraper. And then progress as we decide on, we define specs, like the brace, these are the brace dimensions, these are the top dimensions. Then they will go to machine made so that I can replicate them exactly as if a factory would do it. So that essentially the guitar that you have on loan right now is a machine made guitar made by me, by myself, just using high-end machines to make it, like CNC cut braces, and everything is like as precise as it can be and replicatable as it can be, so that exactly the dimensions and exactly everything that I just did here can be done in Japan. So essentially it's not a matter of like who's making it anymore. That we try to slowly work that out of the process without losing the touch of the human, kind of like the handmade feel to the guitar. Because I can't make tens of thousands of guitars. Yeah. Eventually, I think it is a goal or a hope that guitars that we make here could be purchased. But right now, that there's no system in place for that. Right now, I'm making 40 guitars a year, and that's just prototypes and development. And a lot of that is like we don't want that stuff to make it out full time, because it's like, well, this is a prototype, and we've decided to go past that. So this is ultimately we've decided this is not a the Yamaha guitar we want everybody to own. So I can't, like, we can't just give away those or sell prototypes and stuff. And it's like, I don't think I can make production guitars. I don't think I can sell guitars beyond how many I'm making each year. So if we expand and like get more builders, who knows?
Yeah. The one you sent me had no label on the inside. So I don't even know like what the back, you just said Adirondack spruce for the top. I don't know what's on the, I don't know what the secret sauce is. And then it had the Yamaha, you know, the logo, but doesn't spell out Yamaha. So I guess my question is, would I be able to A, B and test, would I be able to distinguish the guitar you made in California versus one made in Japan? I mean, I don't even know where this one came from.
The one you have came from here.
Okay.
And it purposely doesn't have a label on the inside because anything that sees the public has any sort of marking on it. It's like, well, what if we decided we wanted to change the name? But now somebody's got, or maybe took a picture of a guitar that says, you know, Andrew Enns Yamaha on it. It's like, no, Yamaha doesn't want to call this the Andrew Enns model, or who knows. But yeah, it should be, because the one you have on loan is essentially the end, the last specs. My hope is that the ones that you will be able to buy from Japan will be indistinguishable from that one. Because that one is it. That one is the spec. There's a, that one is Indian rosewood, I believe, for the back and sides.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking, but
yeah.
Be totally sure.
Yes.
What's the timeline on this thing? Like, what, you know, you've taken all the time in the world to go through 40 different prototypes, but when are these actually going to see the light of day in stores?
Yeah. I can't promise it exactly when, because it does keep fluctuating as we're recovering from COVID and catching up to backlog of guitars. I mean, everybody in the guitar industry knows that, you know, guitars are gangbusters right now. Mm-hmm. Everybody's selling a ton and they can't catch up. So Yamaha's in the same situation. We have to catch up to back orders and tool for a new product or a new production of guitars that actually have some different processes in them that Yamaha's never done before. Yamaha's never made an Adirondack spruce top guitar before. Mm. So sourcing the Adirondack spruce, that was a whole part of the development process too, is materials testing, because Yamaha's involved in not just musical instruments, but in, you know, everything like
motorcycles
and car parts and all kinds of stuff. There's a whole materials development department, and they test the wood to determine its characteristics so that they can put in essentially come up with like an algorithm that the computer recognizes as Adirondack spruce for their simulations. Because a 3.2 millimeter thick Adirondack spruce top will behave differently than a 3.2 millimeter thick Sitka spruce top. Mm-hmm. So you can't just say spruce in the computer. It has to be specific. And then, sourcing new materials, testing new materials, aging new materials is a long process as well. But I think right now that the schedule is mid 2023. These guitars should be rolling off the line.
All right.
And because of COVID, I have not had a chance to make it to Japan to play the production prototypes yet, and I'm dying to. I've seen pictures of them, the same guitars made by the Japanese factory. And I'm like, they look good. They look just like it. How do they sound? And I'm just taking their word for it. Like, they sound really good. But I want to compare. So I haven't had the opportunity to do that yet.
How mind-boggling is the Yamaha factory in Japan where the guitars are made? Can you...
In Japan, it's not that mind-boggling. Okay. It's fairly modest because it's expensive still to manufacture. It's essentially like making things in the United States. It's expensive to make things in Japan. Their factory is is fairly modest. It's not, I mean, it's, you know, they've got it dialed in for sure, but it's not like this giant, you know, mega factory. In China, the factory that they own is a mega giant factory. Mm-hmm. I heard something that it was like, because they make all acoustic instruments. They make acoustic guitars and like violins and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Something like 1 million instruments a year out of that factory.
Wow. Yeah. So I'm guessing you're already on to your next thing that you're not even allowed to talk about.
Oh, correct. Yeah. it's an acoustic guitar. I'll tell you that, you know, but, the Yamaha does, you know, want to keep a tight lip on all stuff that's going on R&D wise, because it takes a long time to develop. Yeah. And because, you know, who knows what the final product will be. I can't say anything, because maybe it'll change in a year.
Yeah.
And what I said today won't be true anymore.
Yeah. Well, until you force me to send this thing back, I'm going to enjoy playing it and having some visitors play it, which I'm super excited about. And I don't know what you did. I don't know if it's the technology or just you build a damn fine guitar, but I'm thoroughly impressed by it.
Well, I like to say it's a combination of both. I think the touch of a guy who makes guitars by hand, handmade luthier, and a team of engineers who can, you know, simulate what an amazing guitar should do virtually. I think that kind of combination seems to be working. I mean, it's sort of where Yamaha's the pioneers of something like that. I don't know of anybody kind of going into as much of a depth of design and R&D as Yamaha. I mean, it blows my mind how deep, I mean, how much research we got.
Yeah.
How much, kind of jumping back a minute to, like you said, that guitar doesn't even have a label on the inside. That's because we're still doing the research and development on what kind of paper and font and adhesive to use for the inner label.
We all know Garamond is going to round off those high end notes. Insane. I'm thoroughly, wow.
Yeah. But that guitar, right now we're at the stage where we want to get these guitars, the final prototypes, in as many hands as we can. Mm-hmm. Because it's sort of like, hey, did you know that Yamaha can make this? Yeah. And a lot of people, it's like, no, I didn't know Yamaha could make this. You know, for the longest time, Yamaha's made high-end guitars forever. I mean,
yeah.
But for the longest time, they've kind of been catered for the Asian market. I mean, high-end Yamaha is commonplace in Japan and China, but in the US, it's like, no, not really. You know, you could find them, but they're not as popular as, you know, American made. And so it's kind of now like, hey, let's make a high-end Yamaha, because we know we can, and let's make it for the American market. That's kind of what this guitar is for.
Very cool. You started as a guy wanting to make a copy of a PRS. Have you turned into like a vintage Dreadnought nerd now?
I have not turned into a vintage Dreadnought nerd. Actually, that, you know, to try not to get too controversial, I'm not a huge fan of the vintage sound. I know what it is, and over lots and lots of research and trying, it's like, okay, this is the vintage sound. This is how to achieve that vintage sound. What is the new sound? How do we appeal to the vintage sound without basically just being a vintage, kind of ripping off that vintage thing? And so I still would say I'm an electric guitar player who makes acoustic guitars. Because if I'm left alone to play guitar, I generally play electric guitar. But I also still love nylon string. I love acoustic because of the process, because that it's all inclusive. The guitar, when you're done building the guitar, it makes its own sound.
Yeah.
It doesn't require anything extra. Like that's kind of the, even on all these prototypes, that guitar that we sent doesn't have a pickup in it. I don't even think it has like end pins in it or anything like Mm-mm. that.
No, there's no end pin.
Yeah. It's just like just purely acoustic. And that's kind of comes from the classical world where it's, you know, putting electronics in a guitar is almost sacrilegious. But not that we won't. Yamaha is actually makes proprietary electronics for acoustic, and they sound phenomenal. And we will release a version of this guitar with those proprietary electronics in it that are tuned. Like the EQ is tuned for each specific body shape.
Yeah.
So
love it.
Which is, beyond what anyone else does. I don't know. Like I sometimes just like brag, like, did you know that we do this? That's pretty amazing, right? Who else tunes their electronic system specifically for each model, each body shape? Yeah.
Well,
people just slap in a Fishman or Mellar bags.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you know this already, but it was a pleasure talking to you, and you have one of the most enviable jobs in all of guitar making. You got to make 40 different iterations of the same guitar on your own timeline and really have access to technology most guitar makers never even see.
The luxury is not lost on me, believe me. Actually, for the longest time, I was like, man, I want to build guitars, but like, it just doesn't seem like anybody can do it. Like independent guys, it's like a side job for just about everybody. It's so hard. And I was like, I just need to find that Andy Powers gig. How did that guy land that gig? And it's like, kind of discovered this Yamaha thing. And I'm like, I think I found it. Like,
I think you did.
And so like, I'm a Yamaha lifer now. So, you know,
well, I can see why. And the guitar is fantastic, like I said. So thank you enough for letting me try it out.
Yeah. And you know, we want you to let everybody play it. Don't hoard it. Make sure
we won't. Knows about it. We'll share it. I promise. Yeah.
And I always tell people, like, we've gone to a couple shows now, displayed a few guitars, and they come up to them and like, do you mind if I play it? I won't scratch it, I promise. And I'm like, play it. I don't care if you scratch it. Yeah. You know, like, it's you're supposed to play it. I want to hear what it sounds like, you know. All the playing and all the wear adds to the character of a guitar. You know, once the second I'm done building it, that's when it should be perfect. Every moment past that, it's like, that's no, now it's living its life, you know. Let it happen.
I love it.
Yeah. All right.
Thanks, Andrew.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me and letting me gush about my job.
Yeah. Hey, man, I would too. Sounds great.
Yeah.
All right. That was my chat with Andrew from Yamaha Guitars Custom Shop. I thought I knew most of the luthiers in the industry. I did not know Andrew, and I am so glad that I know him now, and I hope you guys feel the same way. Please keep the feedback coming. Podcast@fretboardjournal.com. Till next time.